You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to our SmartCast micro-learning podcast series titled TYK2 Inhibitors for the Management of Plaque Psoriasis, which of your patients may benefit. In this episode, we discuss the role of TYK2 in the pathogenesis of plaque psoriasis. My name is Debbie Anderson, and I'm excited to moderate today's podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Jerry Bagel. He's a clinical professor of dermatology at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, clinical associate professor of dermatology from the University of Pisa, and director of the Psoriasis Treatment Center of Central New Jersey in East Windsor, New Jersey. Welcome, Dr. Bagel. We're excited to have you here today.
Thank you. Looking forward to discuss treatment of psoriasis.
All right, Dr. Bagel, we do have a few questions that I wanted to ask you so that we can have a better understanding of TYK2 in the pathogenesis specific to plaque psoriasis. Are you all set?
Ready to go.
Can you briefly describe what a TYK2 inhibitor is and why it's important?
So a TYK2 inhibitor tends to be of small molecule, less than 500 Daltons, that could be taken orally and absorbed through the stomach and ends up dispersing through most of the cells, mostly importantly are the immune cells. And what TYK2 inhibitors specifically do are they inhibit the phosphorylation of STAT, signal transducing and transmitting molecule. And that's the molecule that goes to DNA to transcribe, in this case, interleukin 17. So there's a few different ways in which one can inhibit TYK2. And the most common way, not the deucrivacitinib way, the most common way is to inhibit the ATPase site. And the ATPase site for TYK2 is similar to the ATPase site for JAK1 and JAK2 and JAK3 and JAK4. So if you inhibit the ATPase site, you're going to have maybe more efficacy, but you're going to have side effects by inhibiting the other JAK molecules like bone, metabolic. And so what deucrivacitinib does, it doesn't bind in the conservative ATPase site. It binds on the other subunit of the TYK2 molecule. There's two subunits to the TYK2 molecule. And it binds it, and it's called allosteric inhibition, because what that molecule does, that TYK2 inhibitor, deucrivacitinib, by binding the other site, it results in a conformational change in the ATPase site, specifically in TYK2. Doesn't have anything to do with JAK1, JAK2, JAK3, JAK4. It results in a conformational change within the ATPase site, so it no longer can phosphorylate STAT. So that is one of the unique features of, it's brilliant actually, one of the unique features of deucrivacitinib, that it inhibits TYK2 by kind of binding it a little far out and twisting that molecule around. And that results in a much safer molecule because it's not hitting all the ATPase sites of the other JAKs.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for explaining that for us. Can you tell us what role TYK2 plays in the pathogenesis of plaque psoriasis?
Tyrosine kinase, TYK2, phosphorylates STAT, which goes to the nucleus of the cell and transcribes interleukin 17, which we know is important in the hyperproliferation of the epidermis, i.e. psoriasis. That's what TYK2 does. It basically activates STAT, which is the signaling, transcription, and transporting molecule that goes to the nucleus. Now, when that happens, that results in IL-23 activating the cell to produce IL-17, which we know is in epidermal cells, neutrophils, macrophages, and they're all producing IL-17 that keeps the pathogenesis of psoriasis going on. So that's what TYK2 does. It's like a conduit from the receptor being activated to the molecule that goes to the nucleus that starts producing IL-17.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how TYK2 inhibitors compare in efficacy to other available treatment options?
Sure. So the one TYK2 inhibitor that is FDA approved today is deucravacitinib, an oral molecule, 6 milligrams taken every day. By week number 12, you're going to get a PASI 75 of about 65 to 70% and a PASI 90 of 45%. That is similar to one of the molecules we used to use in the past called Stelara. Deucravacitinib is an oral molecule. It is the best oral molecule that we have for the treatment of psoriasis today. However, we also have biologic agents such as risankizumab that after 12 weeks, after 16 weeks rather, you have a PASI 90 of 75%. So in many ways, if you look at the data, the clinical trial phase 3 data, the IL-23 inhibitors subcutaneous have higher efficacy than deucravacitinib, yet some people prefer to take an oral route.
Can you describe what patient would benefit from using a TYK2 inhibitor? And do you think it's related to other factors such as severity, comorbid factors, psoriasis type, or something else?
Actually, I don't. In my experience, see, I don't believe deucravacitinib should be pigeonholed into either scalp psoriasis, genital psoriasis, less intense psoriasis, less severe. I've had situations where I've had people that have body surface area 40% severe, have failed an IL-23, have failed an IL-17, and I put them on deucravacitinib, and within 6 weeks, they're almost clear. I've had other cases that were milder, and it didn't touch them. So I would say that an appropriate place to go would be, let's say, scalp psoriasis. Scalp psoriasis, someone's coming to your office, they've tried 5 different topicals, they say nothing works, you open up the bag, 2 things they didn't even try because they're so frustrated. And I think sometimes when you go with scalp psoriasis from there to a shot, people are a little bit taken aback. So I think in this case, scalp psoriasis, more, palmar plantar psoriasis, there's good data, inverse psoriasis, genital psoriasis, I think those are really good subjects, patients, to treat with deucravacitinib first line. But I do not believe that deucravacitinib should be not used in the more severe individuals because I've seen it work many a time.
Are there any side effects with TYK2 that we should be made aware of in comparison to some of the other medications that are available?
Well, the background story is what scares people. TYK2 is not the same as JAK1, is not the same as JAK2 or JAK3 or JAK4. TYK2, when you inhibit it, only has an effect on the immune system. So therefore, it's not going to necessarily have other effects that you see with tofacitinib, like pulmonary embolisms, thrombophlebitis, lymphoma. What I do see, I've seen a couple of cases of pneumonia. So I warn patients about upper respiratory tract infections. I've seen pneumonias in biologic agents as well, and I haven't seen a significant number, but I warn people of that, upper respiratory tract infections. I do check their cholesterol and triglycerides, again, about 2 months after, if I know that they're going to continue on the drug from good efficacy. So I check fasting triglycerides, cholesterol, liver functions, and CBC with DIF, because there's some reported cases of neutropenia without having any clinical symptoms. So I think upper respiratory tract infections are the most common. I don't see things like I do in other treatments like candidiasis. I don't see that like I do with IL-17s. I don't have to worry about ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease like I do in IL-17s. I don't have to worry about demyelinating diseases like multiple sclerosis, Guillain-Barré, Bell's palsy, transverse myelitis like I do in TNF inhibitors. And, so overall, I think the safety profile is pretty good.
You mentioned before how there were some drugs that you would have to pay attention to, cholesterol or liver function tests or demyelinating drug, you know, demyelinating diseases or some of the other things. When you're looking at a patient or when you have a patient with psoriasis, are you considering, or are you thinking about, this person wouldn't do well because of this adverse effect or this problem, or you're focusing on this drug would be better because of the mechanism of action, or, you know, what goes into your determination for using X drug over another drug?
So one of the beauties of deucravacitinib, it has absolutely no drug-drug interactions. You don't even have to worry about other drugs. You don't have to worry about if they're on a cholesterol-lowering agent. You don't have to worry about if they're on even cyclosporin. You wouldn't do it, but you wouldn't have to worry about it for a drug-drug interaction. So the first thing I do is I look at the patient. I look at the body surface area. I look how thick it is. Then I get them dressed and I talk to them about what they've been on in the past and also what medical problems there are. If someone, for instance, has a history of COPD, I'm probably not going to put them on a biologic agent so quick. If someone had MS, I'm not going to put them on a TNF inhibitor. The most important factor is the genetics. If they have a family member that's been on a drug that worked or didn't work, that's really important. Other than that, some medications, although deucravacitinib is not one of them, don't work as well in people that are like over 220 pounds. I mean, for instance, ustekinumab, over 90 kilograms, you have to use 90 milligrams. Under, you have to use 45. So weight has a lot to do with it. I would say that as far as deucravacitinib goes, the best thing that's going to happen is, and we've been involved with this, is pharmacogenetics and looking at what's the genotype and correlating that genotype with what biologic or medication is most likely to correlate with efficacy. It's hard, like, you know, if somebody had a malignancy within the last 5 years, you probably don't want to put them on anything. But sometimes you can cut that short if you have to. It's hard to look at, you know, like age. Sometimes that doesn't even play that much into efficacy. Gender doesn't play that much into efficacy. I'd say even psoriatic arthritis, sometimes you can get their psoriasis really well, but then their joints don't get better and vice versa. So I don't really have a factor other than pharmacogenetics.
Have you ever considered, or does it ever come up where patients are saying, well, I'd rather do an oral versus an injectable, or, you know, I've tried all the orals, give me an injectable?
Yeah, sure. So remember, biologics, the first biologic was Amiviv on February 1st, 2003. So we're 20 years beyond the first subcutaneous molecule for psoriasis. And yes, in the beginning, I'd say physicians, dermatologists, and patients were a little uptight about biologics and shots. Well, guess what? Then came Ozempic. And now now shots are fine. I mean, it doesn't matter anymore, especially shots four times a year that 80% of the people can stay clear for at least 5 years. So I think shots really have become less of an impediment than before. Although some people, when you offer a pill, Their eyes open up because they didn't realize there was a pill that's available, and some of them are willing to go on it.
So Dr. Bagel, is there anything that, now that we've had this discussion on TYK2 inhibitors, is there anything that you want to say to the listeners or anything specific about TYK2 inhibitors that you think would be beneficial for them to know about when they're considering it for their patients?
There's new developments in TYK2 studies. We're actually doing another one with a company called Takedo. And efficacy looks good. It looks good. But in clinical trials, sometimes efficacy looks a little better than reality. I think having an oral option would be terrific. What I am opposed to is using apremilast. I don't use apremilast, and many of my colleagues do. Apremilast only works 30% of the time, results in nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, depression, and weight loss. And they don't need any blood work, and you just write a script. But my way of thinking, it's like the triamcinolone of the 21st century. It doesn't do much. I don't like to offer it because most of my patients won't do well. deucravacitinib, the new developing TYK2s, have their place because people deserve an oral option if they want to, and this one works well enough. I usually, as I'll talk about later, say give it at least 8 weeks. If you don't see 30% improvement in 8 weeks, we'll pull the plug. But let's give it 8 weeks and see how we do. And most people are willing to go that route.
I want to thank Dr. Bagel for giving us his insights today on TYK2 inhibitors. We really appreciate his feedback. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group in support of improving patient care. MedLearning Group is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. I would also like to give special thank you to our supporter, Bristol Myers Squibb, who provided an educational grant for this activity. I want to thank you all for listening today, and we look forward to seeing you on the next SmartCast Microlearning Podcast Series.